as this panel would call non-novel Buddhism in the United States. And so one of the things that sort of your collective panel sort of raised for me in terms of the question of how then does affect, specifically practices of sort of embodied sensory practices and the ways that they formulate engagements both with each other and more broadly, sort of shape the ethos which exceeds the terminology of fundamentalism. And that was just sort of, how are you guys dealing with that? Because, you know, the Buddhists with whom I work, they would use terms like compassion, you know, versus justice, or bodhi resolve, resolving, and these other frameworks through which they would understand. They would never say that they were Buddhists. They look at me blankly. You know, and so similarly, like the ways that they formulate themselves as persons are quite different. I'm just wondering how the monotheists respond.
Well, that, I mean, so that's something that in my research, it's really hard to study. Especially the main church that I studied is a fairly charismatic evangelical megachurch, you know, of like 6,000 people at each Sunday morning service with like 40 minutes of Christian rock music. People are jumping up and down, singing songs about freedom, often the most, one of their most favorite. So I kind of had to think a lot about the role of affect in kind of congealing kind of evangelical, like a huge part of evangelical practice, which, interestingly, doesn't always, like, I feel like that mobilization of affect in this religious practice doesn't necessarily always lead to specifically this, the kind of ethical and political aspects of the religious movement that I study. But it's a huge part of it. And I think that in some ways, you know, we were having this conversation about freedom and these biases about freedom. And, like, of course everyone wants freedom, but then, you know, especially cultural anthropologists, we know that culture shapes our ideas about subjectivity. It shapes our ideas about ourselves. You know, there's like very, we have to kind of complexify what freedom actually means. But what I came to see is that affect kind of provides especially the music and like the mobilization of affect in evangelicalism provides a lot of kind of either value added or like kind of important sensory experience that shapes identity. It's hard to think of, I mean, I don't know if your question was also about the role of affect in kind of the preconceived ideas about fundamentalism as well, which I was just trying to think through, and it's hard to, I don't know if anyone else wants to comment on that.
If I understand your question, and I'm not sure if I 100% do, Robert, but I think in some ways my own movement away from prayer and worship was in part because I had a hard time understanding that form of affect. And my work with kids, like little kids and mothers, was very easy to understand. Like the kinds of, you know what I mean? There was a kind of, that kind of everyday, you know, parent, child, disciplining your child, what happens to the kid who's defiant, like all of those kinds of things, those were easy affective bonds that we shared culturally, basically. And so when I went to synagogue, I often had a hard time understanding the kinds of affective experiences that people described in terms of beauty and how being there made them feel, because it was a leap for me. And I didn't know how to make it. I talked and I listened and I tried to understand it, but I don't think I experienced that.
Dan Grisco, as someone who grew up in a fundamentalist Baptist church, went to Evangelical Wheaton College and studied Islam, I greatly appreciate it. But something Omri said, I wanted to ask a question, and that is, I wonder to what extent, you know, we're focusing on whatever term you want to use, fundamentalism versus liberal, to what extent self-identity at the ethnographic level is often more on groups that are very closely allied to you. Because I certainly found that when I was a kid in a Baptist church, and there was a general association of regular Baptists or garbage Baptists, whatever they were called, but the enemy was really this other Baptist church.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, in your own field work, you found that identity at that local level is in some ways more meaningful by those who we would lump together as being all the same. That was
Yeah, if can I mean, this actually, I'm not sure if this directly addresses it, but you reminded me of something that I was thinking earlier, which is that by talking about non-liberal, the one thing that we haven't done is clarified its other, which is liberal, right? And specifically liberal religious. And certainly, I don't know if this is, I mean, I don't know if the Baptists down the street were liberal or just other Baptists, and that was the problem, but... Right, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, certainly one of the reasons why I like using the word conservatives precisely for the reason that Ilo is using the word non-liberal is because it historicizes the people. It's not a kind of timeless category. It's very specific to a certain moment, and it's very specific to a moment in which, you know, Baptists define themselves to a large extent by their opposition or their avoidance of the things that liberal Protestants do. The fundamentalist movement that I described earlier, that defense of biblical orthodoxy, was a defense against liberal biblical hermeneutics and secular values and Darwinism and all that other stuff, which may also kind of link me a little bit to Robert's question, in the sense that I was thinking about how do the evangelicals I studied sort of use modes of affect as a way to complicate too neatly classified a religious identity. And one of the ways that the people I studied did it is by, like you said, actually trying to orient themselves towards ethics of care and compassion through embodied practices and practices of organized benevolence. But that precisely became the problem, right? Because you want to do things that liberal Protestants do, but you don't want to do it the way that they do it. So, and that's not just in terms of the strategic level, like how you give, how you do charity, but also how you talk about it, how you feel about it, what the source of your feeling about it is. And so, yeah, that raises a lot of very interesting issues.
Thank you both for your questions. And I wanted to say, with regard to Dan Verisco's stuff, because one of the wonderful things about being the co-chair is people will engage with me about the panel that's coming up, and Dan sent me a paper that he'd written about fundamentalists crusading against fundamentalists, Christian, quote-unquote, fundamentalists, and especially with regard to affect, comic books that are kind of raging against fanatic Muslims and this kind of thing, which is an interesting use of kind of affective, very aesthetically laden kind of imagery. To have this kind of inter-religious kind of conflict, aka crusades, etc. So I appreciated that, by the way. And that got me thinking, as did Robert's question, about the role of affect in the settings I'm describing, where many of the divisions among the Muslim groups in Nigeria, specifically northern Nigeria, are often indexed. Conveniently by different kind of bodily or aesthetic practices. So like whether music is used in ritual or not, whether one can celebrate the prophet's birthday or not, like these, you know, which is a joyous occasion, and there's all sorts of kind of performances involved with it, and some people find that rather innovative, which is bad, and others find it very worshipful. And so like these questions often, I can't say that, you know, it's affect or not affect. It's like the kinds of affect that become indexically associated with different modes of religiosity are really important to keep track of. And even the way that, you know, we kind of indexically associate kind of fundamentalist Islam, you know, which was kind of hyperbolized in the comic books you talked about, that like the raging angry Muslim, right? Or the evangelicals who are as a fundamentalist as an evangelical is angry about something, like the effect of anger. And many of the more pious Muslims that I knew and know in northern Nigeria are really upset with that image and with their fellow Muslims who seem to be purveying that image, because they often will prefer to be identified with compassion. Especially compassion towards others, like social welfare, outreach, charity. That's charity being often a term that's used. So that people will often say, these aren't real Muslims. A real Muslim is compassionate. A real Muslim is doing these other things, which is, you know, again, it's a very affectively laden thing, but they all are. But, you know, it's the debate is often about those very things.
So that was a lot of questions. Three or four comments from the audience. And then
you guys can kind of respond as well, because if we let all four of you respond to every single comment, we'll have two more people commenting. So we'll start with you.
Why you made all panelists and hidden assumption that fundamentalists, so-called conservatives, are less free than liberals? Of course, in media and statistically, maybe this is true, but if fundamentalist is liberal, is a bigger sinner in point of view of religion, but God, of course, is with very compassionate person and will absolve him. And liberal, it's not necessary more free than fundamentalist. And this is my question.
Okay.
Why would you do this?
Next.
Okay.
Other, good.
Go. I wondered...
Either way.
I wondered if you could comment on what happens, how these movements become political, or would you argue that it's all political all the way from the beginning? But, you know, the part of the discourse is the conjunction of political and fundamental.
My comment is, it seems that we're struggling with this emic conception of people who are engaged in various religious practices. And a lot of those conceptions themselves vary among the peoples themselves. And then there's this whole other category of liberal with all of its emic conceptions, right? And I know a hell of a lot of liberals that I would consider illiberal. So we have this emic set of categories here, and so what I'm hearing is a kind of struggle to try and create some kind of etic language that we can talk about these phenomena. I'm not so sure non-liberal is it, right? You know, but that's what I'm hearing.
I'll take a few more. You have to agree with me.
Yes, I guess everybody here, when you look at fundamentalist beliefs, you try to be open-minded. An idea as possible when you try to understand. And then my question would be, how much of an open-mindedness did you find on the other side to try to understand the general society?
My question is basically grounded in kind of the notion of freedom that talk about how fundamentalists still see themselves as free and whatnot, and I guess my question is somewhat based on my own project, but how do you see people who have left the fundamentalist programs and how they're often kind of, they leave in search of that freedom and kind of how they see freedom in that sense that, they're searching for their own freedom, yet their fundamentalist background sees freedom within their own, religion or ideologies or whatnot.
Kind of like,
okay, one more.
Yeah. I think that there's one element that I think is being left out of the discussion, and that is the extent to which the religions are proselytizers. Now, I would exclude that from the Hasidic moment. I think that both the comparison with them would be more with the Amish. But if you take most fundamental Christian sects, and if you take most Islamic sects, they're not just passive, and they are trying to spread and they're trying to convert other people to their position. And I think one of the things that you have in northern Nigeria is actually a competition between evangelical Christians and Muslims to get the upper hand. And I think if we're having the debate about religion, you can't ignore the fact that both Christians and Muslims are trying to spread the religion. Whether that's benign or it's not benign is a different matter, but I think that has to be taken into account.
Well, those are fascinating comments. I'm sure you can't address all of them, but let's give you guys a few moments to make some comments, and then we'll go back to the audience for a few more comments. Anyone want to take on any of those fascinating questions and comments?
I can say just really, really briefly. I think that in terms of the ex-fundamentalist question, so in my own research, I did study a lot of, I interviewed several people who had kind of were brought up in the evangelical movement and have left. But I think honestly, one of the most interesting examples of that is this essay that Michael Warner wrote. I forget the title. Think so, but where he talks about how he was brought up in a very religiously conservative kind of Bible-believing family, and he's talking about how, you know, like the kind of almost experience of like the ecstatic experiences that he had as a child, like debating like these huge concepts with his parents about God and like the role of God, you know, and like what heaven's going to be like, and it's just like he said that he's never been able to replicate like that same type of kind of effective experience, right? And so I'm sure he would, you know, he's not going back, right, to that experience. But I think that it kind of brings up that maybe not this, that like, on the one hand, we like the liberal perspective is to value freedom above everything else, but that, you know, there's also a lot of other types of experiences, like kind of a satiated, kind of effective emotional experience that a lot of religious mobilizations can conjure up and create that are very satisfying, even if they're not the same type, you know, like defined by liberal ideas of freedom.
Those are all really interesting questions. I'm going to answer a little bit, try to combine three and four of the freedom and openness on the other side. Since I've been working more with people who are either leaving or losing their faith and staying in their community, I see two trends. One is the people who leave seem to completely trash, as I sort of hinted at earlier, the communities where they grew up. But then I've also been seeing a lot of debates on Facebook and on blogs that in fact the ultra-Orthodox communities of today have it wrong, and they provide textual sources. So they reread the texts, like the religious texts, and argue that in fact their version of Judaism with all of its skepticism is actually more authentic, which raises all kinds of interesting issues in terms of debate, using religious textual debate to support different kinds of positions. And in terms of open-mindedness, I would say not that much. I mean, a real generosity and an openness to including. And actually, there are lots of Jews who proselytize in very similar ways to Christians and Muslims. Think of the Torah tanks that roam our streets, right? The mitzvah mobiles, sorry. And I mean, that's Lubavitch, but also even the communities that I were working in that were not active proselytizers are always hoping to gain new members and that their example will entice you to join them. And I was just at a wedding last week and someone said to me, "You still weren't convinced, were you?" Yeah. So there's always the hope that maybe soon that their example, which they're proud of as the kind of freedom of maturity and not like, as they often portray the Gentile world, of like wanton, immature freedom. Instead, it's a kind of mature, controlled, goal-oriented life that they feel is much, I guess that's the affective part, Robert, right? Yeah, I just realized that. so thank you. That is really like their legitimation for why they're doing what they do.
Yeah, these are all really good questions. I think the one that I'm gravitating towards responding is the question about emic and edic distinction, and what are we struggling to do here? And I think that for me at least, that I mean, that was sort of the basis of my comments in a lot of ways, because I think we're certainly, those of us working on working in areas where the specter of fundamentalism as a concept or as a political movement or as a category is certainly very present. So we need to contend with it in some way. And so for me, it's a question of distinguishing its emic and edic significance. And when and if we take some of these and turn them into edic categories like fundamentalism, which the Fundamentalist Project aimed to do, then when and how do we use those categories, and what do they do for us? What do we do with them? But I'm also interested in what do they do to us? And that's why I'm always qualifying words like that. And I think qualifying not to be apologetic, but I mean, I think that part of what good ethnography does is sort of qualify generalized concepts, not to erase their generalizability, but to nuance them. And even a word like evangelical, it has these emic and edic connotations that are very often at odds with each other. I mean, like I said, in the middle of the 20th century, folks like Billy Graham came around and said, look, let's stop being like these angry fundamentalists. Let's revive this name evangelical and let's champion this approach, which, you know, is old but new, when they call themselves the new evangelicals. And then what happened? Fast forward 50 years and every 3 months, or 6 months or whatever, there's a cover story on Newsweek or Life or something that says, what is an evangelical? Who are the evangelicals? I mean, I get Google alerts. I know how often these things are coming out. And it's fascinating to me because it's, again, it really reemerged in public discourse as an emic category that then scholars have been scrambling to come up with the edic chemical makeup of, right? It's as if like you had a bunch of children who invented a game. And then a bunch of other children who started arguing about what the rules of that game should be. You know what I mean? I mean, we lose sense of the internal constructedness and the oppositional nature of that category, evangelical, which again I use. I have the possible fortune of using it for people who are very much part of that legacy. But what I think this panel really highlights is that there is a tremendous amount of slippage, and we don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater, but we have to be on our guard, I guess, when we choose the particular words that we use and decide what is it that we want them to do for us, as opposed to assuming that they have neat definitions and that they will take us somewhere that we want to be.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah.
I'll try to be brief. I want to say that my comment about not valuing freedom wasn't to say that fundamentalists are less free. It was about the way people engage with the concept of freedom. And I think, again, the fact that I've done my research outside the United States in a place that does not call itself the land of the free, I think that's important. Like the fact that, you know, evangelicals can affiliate with the Tea Party because it's all about freedom, that's not the political rhetoric that functions in Nigeria. It's just not the way it works, which isn't to say that people don't say that there's freedom in Jesus or freedom in Islam, but it's just not it's not the privileged rhetorical trope. That's all I was saying. It was about rhetoric, not about actual freedom. But that's important. And I'm recalling my first visit to Nigeria ever in 1991, where I was asked what I was by Muslim neighbors. I said Christian because I was raised Catholic, and, you know, I'm always Catholic in that sense. I'm not doctrinally Catholic, and I am a believer, but I'm very fuzzy about what I believe. And so I was hedging and hawing. And my interlocutor, who was a pretty well-educated bilingual Hausa English Muslim, Hausa English-speaking Muslim, said, oh, you're a free thinker. And which was like a bad thing. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, oh. And I was like, oh, that's not a good thing. So that's also where I'm coming from with regard to this. And the thing is that I'm faced with, on the one hand, you've got in Nigeria various groups, various Christian groups competing with each other. And this is like, how did it become political? It's always been political. The historical work about pre-Islamic northern Nigeria was about the ways in which religion and politics worked in those pre-Islamic kingdoms. When those kings or queens a couple times embraced Islam, it became political. When the British came in, it stayed political, and it's been political ever since. It's the way the relation between politics and religion works out. And in the contemporary Nigerian sphere, as was said, there's a lot of competition among various churches for bodies and the money that they bring and the political power that they bring, both vis-a-vis the state and vis-a-vis economic resources. So even when people who are not especially committed to the proselytizing nature of their faith are confronted with the fact that, like, that group is getting what we should be having, they're kind of brought into it. So it's very much about political economy in that regard. And you know, despite all of that diversity and internal competition between Christians and Muslims and among Muslims and among Christians, there seems to be this like overriding agreement that as long as you're one of them, as long as you're something, you're okay. So to be a free thinker or to be an atheist is just like unheard of. Like unheard of, which is again why, even though I'm not an anthropologist of religion, I can't avoid and won't avoid engaging with the topic.
I'm feeling like there might be some other comments from the audience. So
yes.
Now.
Right. Yes. Well, Rudy addressed a bit of this thing that I wanted to say. The question I have in my mind from the beginning, and then we addressed it recently. Is the question of the two categories, fundamentalism and liberal, because the term liberal here in the United States is in itself, as fundamentalism, very often an insult. I know that, I can tell you.
Yeah.
Because in the country, my plumber, my an old gardener who was very racist, etc., would constantly told me he was trying to convert me to being really a person, a rightist. And he would, one day I said, don't count on it. You know, he was trying. And he told me, well, I've yet to meet an academic that was not a liberal. And, you know, and in several contexts, liberal is the parallel of fundamentalist. And so you are starting from within already two, and you have to address the two.
I recognize the dilemma and creating categories that you used, in a sense, establish some sort of project of research. But I think the gentleman who spoke about Nigeria grounded his work very meaningfully in what resources are being claimed, what people are being excluded, and how monopolies over resources are being established by naming individuals us versus them. And I would like to see a parallel enterprise for U.S. studies, which generally speaking, at least in anthropology, are not so common. In other words, what happens in New York, what happens elsewhere, is not disconnected from, you know, basic resources, power structure, and other elements in which people try to create pools of us that can, in a sense, sequester, i.e., in a better term, access to those resources.
So the move is going to kind of say that terms and categories should be, rooted in a specific place and a specific time, but I can't help but think that there's also this kind of larger genealogy. It's kind of a conjoined genealogy of liberalism and the term fanaticism. And when you read, how Luther writes about the peasants who are rising up and about Thomas Mussa and he calls him a fanatic and a shaman and uses that as a pejorative term, it sounds a lot like the way liberal pundits will rail against, the fundamentalists. And then you actually see, with Kant and Alberto Toscano has kind of told a story about this term, fanaticism. And I wonder if fundamentalism is kind of a continuation of that genealogy of using a term to refer to kind of subjectivities that do not comply with a certain liberal conception of how one ought to be.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks. I wanted to mainly talk to Rudy, because I have some experience in Nigeria myself. And I was really inspired by Henri's call for looking at some religious phenomena as assemblages. And it seems to me that you, I don't know if it was to fit into this panel, but you addressed or framed your comments in a Muslim context. yet the people you talked about were Hausa. Mm-hmm. And they certainly self-identified as Hausa. They talked about, you talked about Sharia as if Sharia exists in a single manifestation. And we know from the study done by Women Living Under Muslim Laws that in 23 Muslim countries there are different ways of interpreting this, that, and the other thing. And I was just wondering about the whole category of the Ndaudu and whether or not that's has almost is pasted onto some kind of a Islamic framework, but really has nothing to do with it. It could be some expression of older Hausa traditions, or if it comes from something else within Islam that the men are latching on to. I mean, I'm more familiar with the Yoruba tradition in which men are women and there's all kinds of line breakings, and I assume there's the same thing in Muslim culture as well.
Okay, let's take a few more.
Me?
Not you again. You.
Me.
Yes, you. Yes.
This is maybe mostly also directed to Rudy, or maybe least directed to him. I also work in Africa, and I work with Pentecostals. When I bring up Pentecostals up here, the first thing everybody is like, "Oh, snake handlers," and it's seen, you know, very, very much as a, you know, as backwards looking. And when you look at it in Africa or in the post-colonial countries, that it really challenges that idea, because their Pentecostalism is the religion of modernity, is the progressive, is the newest cutting edge of what people are doing and talking about. So I was sort of wondering, I guess, the way in which this conversation can also contribute to redefining what we mean by modernity, and I don't mean in a contrast to post-modernity. I mean, you know, as in where we're at now, and the ways in which maybe some of the challenges we're coming across is because these ideas of what that means are encoded in all of these terms that we have to use.
Let's take one more, and then we'll leave the last 5 minutes to the panel.
I just wanted to... I think it's interesting that you underplay the importance of freedom, especially since among fundamentalists, especially since in the U.S., so many religious refugees have come to this country to in order to preserve their religion, to escape persecution. And also we have a constitution in which you have freedom of speech and freedom of belief. And what I notice in fundamentalist groups is a conviction of their own religion, but also a lack of tolerance for other religions. And I think that if you want freedom of religion, you need to have religious tolerance. Otherwise, it's impossible. So that would be my comment.
Okay, I wanted to say, I'd love to talk with you one-on-one, because I think we could have some interesting conversation about Hausa Yoruba stuff and everything. So I'll just briefly say that I did probably highlight Muslimness as opposed to Hausa-ness to fit in on this panel. But that's not so inappropriate, given that in northern Nigeria, there's often a slippage where northern Hausa people, Hausa speakers often see themselves as like the exemplars of northern Nigeria and exemplars of Islam in Nigeria, much to the annoyance of other Nigerian Muslims. So I'll just put that out there. So I there were certain rhetorical moves I made that were very specific to this. I also did not mean to imply that Sharia is one thing. In fact, there are debates within northern Nigeria about this thing that they've implemented that they call Sharia, but what about these other Sharias? So that's very much part of it. And that there is much more to be said that I won't say here about where Ndaudu comes from as a phenomenon, and it's not clear about that. That's all I'll say. I with regard to the modernity thing, the Pentecostalism and modernity, I'm reminded of a point where a guy I was talking to, not a Ndaudu, somebody else I was just chatting with, and people were talking about women in women in general and women in Nigeria and women in other countries. And this guy said, you know, women in the West, Western women, they really have freedom. Like in Saudi Arabia, those women really have freedom. And, you know, I'm just going to leave you with that.
I just had a thought and then I lost it.
That's hard.
Yes.
You can do it.
I honestly can't remember. It was something about the terminology. Oh yeah, I mean I just wanted to come back to a point that I raised in my comments, which is that I certainly don't think, and I don't think anyone are saying that these terms are so bad that we can't use them at all, or that we can't use terms at all. But we need to acknowledge their genealogy. We need to acknowledge our positionality in choosing them. Or the way that our positionality influences our choice in using them. And also, and this refers back to what I was saying, that these terms describe a lot and then they also neglect a lot. And so what is important to me is when, you know, people, you know, one of the responses that I get, I didn't talk about the way that people respond to when I say, oh, I work in evangelical megachurches in the South. I get responses like, well, but they're really fundamentalists, aren't they? Or, well, they're really cultish, aren't they? Right? And I mean, these are all concepts that are in play, and they, like I said, they need to be contended with, and they can be useful in some, less so cult, but, you know, they can be useful in one way or another. But if people are asking, or if I were to ask, that term become a way of making everybody satisfied that they know who these people are and which box they belong in, that's what I'm suggesting we avoid, right? And so when my reaction is not to the word fundamentalist, because fundamentalist is it's a style, it's a movement, it is a category that is relevant to both theory and experience in American Christianity at this point. But it's not the equivalent of, you know, it's not on the periodic table of elements, right? I mean, it's not, it can't be that neatly boxed. And I say this from my work because I knew people who called themselves fundamentalists, but for different reasons than others might call them fundamentalists. And they had, in some cases, I wouldn't just say liberal tendencies. I would say in some cases extremely liberal tendencies when it comes to certain kinds of issues. And somebody before us is saying about, like, a lot of liberals aren't that liberal. I mean, that's absolutely true, right? I mean, we can all call ourselves liberal with a capital L, but we know that a lot of the people that we know who say that are not liberals, you know, 5-point liberals, as you might say. So that's simply the point that I would – for me, I guess it's an empirical issue. Right, it's the way that theory and categories are useful only if, as far as I'm concerned, only to the extent that they reveal empirical nuances rather than conceal them.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, Omri, actually, and in a lot of ways, I find myself using a sort of repertoire of terms and then picking and choosing depending on whom I'm talking to and which parts you want to emphasize, which genealogies to emphasize. So that's a helpful way of thinking about it. I just wanted to make a comment about the resources. And I'll speak from a very personal perspective, which is that a lot of my prior work was at the very everyday level in the domestic unit. And I think in some ways I kind of, you know, you can't do it all, but in some ways it was easier to focus on that than to look at the use of resources and what role those kind of micro practices played in the distribution of resources. I don't think that's fair to say of anthropology of religion in the U.S. in general, but for my own case, I feel like I've become more interested in that as my interests have shifted within the community and as I've stopped working as much with children, which is an interesting issue too.
Excellent. Then I can begin by thanking my fellow panelists because I think it's been a great conversation. And I'm going to conclude with a very short thing, and that's just about the comment that liberal can also be used as kind of like a negative term that conjures up its own kind of stories and stereotypes. I think that, yes, going back to Where I actually began with Susan Harding's kind of description of fundamentalists as becoming the repugnant cultural other. The liberal is the repugnant cultural other to, right, people who identify as fundamentalist or conservative, et cetera. And I think, right, there's a lot of kind of smugness, right, that can go with positioning oneself as in one versus the other, and it's that kind of opposition that I think does a lot of work, but it's not necessarily the work that we want it to do as scholars of these movements.
Thanks. Well, this has been a terrific conversation. Thank the four panelists.